Good evening and welcome back to Amandla here on CQUT 90.3 FM in Montreal, CQUT.ca around the world. And for those of you who've missed something or would like to listen to it again, you can visit our blog at addax.wordpress.com. It's been 20 years already since South Africans and the world lost Chris Hani, an amazing individual, a revolutionary, a committed anti-apartheid activist who we lost just before the first non-racial elections in South Africa that officially brought apartheid to an end. And it's hard to imagine how things would have been different if Chris Hani had lived and South Africa had been able to enjoy him for years to come. But unfortunately, that was not to be the case. And tonight we're going to mark the loss of Chris Hani with an interview with Dan O'Meara, who's a former longstanding member of the African National Congress and now a professor of political science at Université du Québec à Montréal. Dan joins us on the phone. Hi, Dan.
Hi, Gwen.
Nice to have you back with us.
Thanks for inviting me.
So, you know, for my parents' generation, I guess the law, everybody remembers where they were when Kennedy was assassinated. I have to say, for me, I remember exactly where I was when I heard the news that Chris Hani had been assassinated. And I not only was I devastated at the loss, but I was really scared for South Africa's future. But that said, here we are 20 years later, and I'm sure that many of our listeners have never even heard of who Chris Hani is. So I thought maybe we could kick off with just a little biographical sketch. Could you tell people about Chris Hani?
Yeah. Chris Hani was, at the time of his assassination, he was the Secretary General of the South African Communist Party, and without any shred of doubt, the most popular politician in South Africa, even more so than Mandela. He was the core and the heart of the ANC before taking over from Joe Slovo as Secretary General of the Communist Party. He had been the head of the ANC's military wing. He was by far the greatest military hero in the ANC. The apartheid regime tried to kill him on four or five occasions. On one case, they missed him and killed 40 other ANC members. Chris Hani was a man of immense political stature, great compassion, someone who fought with immense courage and determination against apartheid, but had not a shred of racism in his soul. He was living in a white working class area when he was shot by a Polish immigrant. And I think, as you said in in your introduction, we will never know what would have happened in South Africa had he lived, but things would have been very different for a number of reasons. He was the opposite of the man who took over from Mandela, Thabo Mbeki. He was Mbeki's rival going back to childhood. They were born within a few months of each other, lived within a few miles of each other, and were rivals all of their lives. Unlike Mbeki, Chris Hani had a real sense of where he wanted the country to go and a real political base and real popular support. So, it's important to understand that not only was Hani assassinated in April 93, but within the space of two or three years, the ANC lost four of its five most important leaders. Joe Slovo died in 96, I think, of leukemia. Mm-hmm. Oliver Tambo died just shortly before Chris Hani. And Walter Sulu retired from politics. They were all people who would have been a counterweight to Mbeki. They all disagreed with what Mbeki did with South Africa. And, it's one of those historical what-ifs, a tragedy in all senses. Yeah.
Yeah. And my understanding is that the scope of the loss was even broader because we lost a lot of sort of maybe less known grassroots organizers and opponents in this period. This was the time when Inkatha was wreaking havoc. It was really a tough time. So could you kind of maybe broaden out the context for us? Because there, as I said, we lost a lot of people in that period that probably did then define a redirection in South Africa's recent history.
Yeah, more ANC people and middle-level cadres were killed in the 4 years between the release of Mandela and the election of the first democratic parliament than in the entire 42-year period, or no, 30-year period of the ANC operating underground. The context was that the regime did a 180-degree turn on the 2nd of February 1990 and announced that it would do what it had always refused to do, and that is negotiate. With the ANC, it would legalize, I think it was some 18 black organizations which had been banned, including the ANC, the Communist Party, and the Pan-Africanist Congress. And the world was euphoric, and very few people understood that de Klerk had, and the South African government had not changed what they wanted South Africa to be. They just realized they weren't going to win. They didn't have the numbers to win by pure oppression, and they needed to end South Africa's international isolation. So they technically opened up the system a little bit, started negotiating with the ANC, sort of negotiating with the ANC. They didn't really do so until Hani was assassinated. And they unleashed, Inkatha was one of the groups, they unleashed death squads all over South Africa. It was an unbelievably dangerous time. Something over 20,000 people, almost 99.9% recurring were black. I think very few whites were killed in political violence in that time. And that was all the regime's doing, the regime and its puppets. It was a horrible time. And the really hideous irony of the assassination of Hani was that it brought the regime to the brink. South Africa exploded. There were riots everywhere, much as there had been, say, in the U.S. when Martin Luther King Jr. Was assassinated. And de Klerk appealed, de Klerk, who was the last white president, appealed to Mandela to make a broadcast to calm things down. And Mandela said to him, "You've been joking us around for 3.5 years. If you want me to stop this, you have to negotiate seriously. You have to accept that apartheid is finally forever over. And within a year, we will have a fully democratic election with one person, one vote," something de Klerk had not yet conceded. And Mandela went on television and he gave an amazing speech, as he, you know, had the tendency to do. It was something along the lines that a white man full of hate came from outside South Africa and killed one of the brightest children of the country. And there was rage about that, but we must also never forget that a white woman saw this assassination, called the police, and the murderer was arrested as a result. And he said to white South Africa, "My compatriots, you have a choice. You can behave out of fear, anger, rage, and murder, or you can choose the path of reconciliation." And, you know, it was a horrendous loss for South Africa, as I've said repeatedly in these few minutes, but it did finally force de Klerk to realize that it was that or total and utter chaos, and that the whites would be swamped if they didn't do something.
Now, you mentioned how few people really understood in this period what was going on, but it would seem that Hani, even though he died before the end of this transition, had a pretty clear understanding of what was going to be the next chapter of struggle in South Africa. Just 8 days before he was assassinated, he gave an interview in which he talked about how South Africa faced a new struggle, an enemy, and he was referring to socioeconomic change, the struggle for jobs, housing, what he called a caring society. And furthermore, he had chosen that he would not run for election, that he felt that power should be built outside of government in order to check its power. So now when we look back over the last 20 years, I mean, we have 2020 hindsight, but there was Hani right there in the period, in the moment, throwing out the warning. To what degree do you think South Africans shared Hani's view of a kind of cautious next phase, and that the struggle wasn't over? And yeah.
Well, I think there are levels and levels to your question. Hani had a degree of political sophistication which very few people ever achieve, and he was one of the very, very few members of the South African Communist Party to keep in mind that the struggle didn't end with the end, the formal end of apartheid. And by the formal end, I mean the legal end, not the economic end. And he was one of the very few members to understand that the real aim of the struggle against apartheid was to end the terrible poverty in which most black South Africans lived. And that could not be done if the ANC went wholeheartedly into government. And particularly if the popular forces believed that they now could stop mobilizing in the streets and that they could, as it were, you know, sit on their hands and think that the main job had been done and leave the rest up to the politicians. I mean, that was essentially that's an essential part of all Marxist analysis of a revolutionary situation, and most communists in South Africa forgot that. Hani, in a sense, was speaking too late because Mandela had done the damage. Very shortly after being released from prison, Mandela decreed that all popular organizations except the ANC and the Communist Party would be dissolved. So the United Democratic Front was dissolved. And he did so without without discussing this with the leadership. Hani was clearly in disagreement with this, so were other people. But Mandela had the kind of moral authority that allowed him to do that. And that was a terrible, terrible, terrible mistake, because it demobilized the population at a stroke. And it meant that any kind of attempt to undo apartheid would, from now on, be a top-down negotiation process led by politicians like Mandela. And Hani understood that that was not necessary. He understood that that was counterproductive. And he was one of the very few people to do so. You know, I've discussed this with Jay Naidoo, who in that time was the Secretary General of the South African Congress of Trade Unions and decided to go into Parliament. He was number three on the ANC list. And he was kicked out 2 years later by Thabo Mbeki, and he considered it to have been a major mistake. He said that the popular organizations should never have allowed their strength to be dissipated by going into Parliament. They should have continued to organize outside. Of course, they should have voted. Of course, they should have followed the political process. Of course, they should have respected democracy. But they should have kept the organized internal democracy and independence that they had from the ANC, and that has gone. And unfortunately, Hani would have been horrified had he known that this would happen. Well, one of the very first organizations to, you know, give it all up was the Communist Party itself. A very large percentage of the ministers of the governments, the successive governments, which has implemented this new neoliberal policy in South Africa, have been members of the Communist Party. So we have this horrendous compromise in South Africa where you have a marriage, a marriage from hell of Thatcherism, Thatcherite economic policies and Stalinist political culture, something which would have appalled Chris Hani. You know, God knows what he would have done to stop it. He was one person. But I do believe things would have been different.
So, well, here we are a generation later. There's a whole generation now that's grown up in a post-apartheid South Africa and are living the effects of these key decisions that were made. Do you think that there are a critical mass of people who are as appalled by what's going on as Chris Hani would have been appalled at and would are mobilizing around his message, even if they, whether they know it was his message or not? I mean, is there kind of a legacy in a way that people can gather around and kind of push this in a new direction?
Yes and no. There are very, very large numbers of South Africans who are appalled by what is happening in the country and what the ANC, the corrupt, grubby little organization it has become. Their capacity to mobilize is limited because they have, I mean, what Mandela did and what the ANC did was to take out the organizational structure that made that possible. Mm-hmm. And there are very, very, very few leaders, I can't think of any off the top of my head, who have the kind of credibility that Hani had and the real political base that Hani had. There may be people who understand the need to do that. But that will not happen until the ANC splits. It must, it has to break up. That is the only hope for South Africa. It has to lose its legitimacy as the organization that brought the end to apartheid in order for a new political mm-hmm. space, and I just don't mean in the formal parliamentary system, but for a new organizing space to emerge. There are local organizations that have developed, and there's a lot of local organization going on, but there's nothing yet to give this a kind of national focus. There's no program. There's no sense of how to go, what to do, how to organize. That hopefully will come, but as I said, it cannot really take off until the ANC begins to break up.
Okay, Dan, thank you so much for joining us tonight. Be well.
Many thanks, Gwen.
I've been in conversation with Dan O'Meara, who's a former longstanding member of the African National Congress and currently a political science professor at Université du Québec à Montréal.
Appreciate
Let
it.
Let me
so.
Loose.
Doug, go.
Today, British Parliament held a special session, 8 hours of tribute to Margaret Thatcher. Can you imagine? They called it was in vacation relief, whatever they call it, for the parliamentarians. 8 hours of tribute to Margaret Thatcher. And an all-star Canadian cast of conservatives, when I really mean reactionaries, are going to her funeral. Stephen Harper, Brian Mulroney, amongst others. Neoliberalism is alive and well, despite her death. And I would really have preferred if we could have had a trial in her memory for her crimes against humanity. It would have been far more appropriate. Let's set this in context a little bit here. The period after the war, the Second World War, from 1940-something on to the early 70s, was a period of unprecedented prosperity in the Western world and, in many ways, change throughout the rest of the world as we decolonized Africa and brought things happening. There were things happening all over. And yet, capital just couldn't accept this compromise where government, workers, and business would share the wealth. Capital wanted it all for itself. And in came 1979, Margaret Thatcher. And in came in 1980, Ronald Reagan. And in came neoliberalism full blossom. We didn't understand. We didn't realize the impact. We didn't understand where they were taking us. Government shouldn't have any business doing business. We had to disinvest whatever government owned. We had to try and sell it off, deregulate, break the unions. Workers' power was far too strong. It was stifling the nation. Privatize. And all this under the aegis of Milton Friedman from the Chicago School of Economics. Thank goodness now all three of them are dead. Oh, I'm sorry. Did I say that? I should never. But anyway, the in the UK, we kept hearing in this last couple of days about how she broke the unions. And yes, that was very, very much part of her strategy. As far as she and capital was concerned, having to share all that money that capital was making with the unions was an offense when it should be all going to them. But you know, what really was going on here was an attack on the workers and the people of the world as it was in the UK represented by what had happened since the war with the nationalization of industry, the coal mines, the steel workers, the auto mines. Everything was run for the benefit of the population Britain was an industrial giant. It came back from the war famously. What did those policies of union breaking do and deregulating and privatization do? It essentially destroyed the industrial infrastructure of Britain. At the same time, it destroyed the public services that Britain had built up over time. Everything from dental care for people to cleaning the streets, it slowly died. And what did we see as a result? Huge, huge problems and turmoil in Britain, including the famous riots in Brixton, the race riots in Britain. Now, this is a show about Africa, so let's go to Africa. What happened there? Neoliberalism, the same politics that she was and Reagan were applying to their own countries, were applied to the Bretton Woods organizations because the money for these organizations, for the IMF and the World Bank, were coming from the leading industrial countries. And they imposed those policies on these organizations. And those organizations imposed those policies on any of those poor countries let's deal with sub-Saharan Africa, that needed a loan. But it was all over the world. It was the same thing. They imposed them through what was known as the Structural Adjustment Programs, SAPs. And it led to death and destruction throughout the Third World. Now, I am not exaggerating when I say this. What we saw was no longer could you protect your home industry. You had to take down tariff barriers, even though they existed all throughout the industrialized world. They had to be taken down in the poor countries. And this opened up nascent industries, struggling industries that were trying to get going, to unfair competition from Western giants and other giants elsewhere. So local industry was destroyed. The government had to pull back investment in local infrastructure. So we saw hospitals closing and infrastructure deteriorating in hospitals and healthcare and education, where the 60s and 70s had seen massive building of schools and hospitals and infrastructure of all sort. The 80s under Thatcher and Reagan saw all that close down and all of it grind to a halt. And listen, I'm not exaggerating. Thousands have died. And I'll use the example in Malawi in 1980, before these people had a chance to put their real policies to work, life expectancy had risen throughout the 60s and 70s to the spiraling heights in Malawi of 51 years. A person born in 1980 could expect to live to 51 years old. That was still pathetic compared to Canada, but it had risen steadily but slowly as healthcare improved, as education improved, as more and more facilities were available, as the infrastructure was there, as education for life was there. By 2003, after 23 years of structural adjustment and neoliberalism, life expectancy in Malawi had fallen to 37 years. It can't be more dramatic than that. So when I say we should be trying these people for crimes against humanity, thousands and millions of people in Malawi and other parts of the poor world suffered directly consequences from the election of Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan, from capital taking over and saying to the rest of the world, bugger you, it's the rich who should profit and the rest of you should suffer. Okay, Gwen, okay. I'm out of breath.
So let me jump in here with another aspect of her legacy, which really has been, I think probably most of us would agree on balance, a pretty poisonous one. And this has to do with her foreign policy in Southern Africa. And, you know, she was absolutely reviled, certainly in South Africa and much of the world over, for being a stalwart supporter of apartheid at a time in the 80s where almost all of the world had rallied itself against the white supremacist regime in South Africa. And yet there was Margaret Thatcher desperately and powerfully helping to support the system. She launched a massive propaganda campaign against the ANC and Nelson Mandela. Nelson Mandela was a terrorist. The ANC was a terrorist organization. And, you know, she really, really pushed that line. And she came up with a whole policy called constructive engagement, which was basically that we need to continue to engage with the apartheid regime and change things slowly, reform it. If we could just tweak it, things would be fine. Whereas the rest of the world was saying that is absolutely ridiculous. This whole system has to be thrown in the garbage, absolutely eradicated. Her constructive engagement program, which the rest of the world called destructive engagement, was really about fighting the world's efforts to impose sanctions and isolate South Africa. And she kept saying, no, no, we have to talk about it. Talk to them. What this really was Margaret Thatcher's business as usual approach to South Africa. And we need to keep in mind that British companies continued operating in South Africa right up until really they never stopped operating, but in that time where a lot of the business world had pulled out, the UK continued to be the biggest trading partner with South Africa, the greatest foreign investor. And Doug, when you were talking about Thatcher's whole philosophy about scaling back government involvement in the free market, I have to laugh. It is so hypocritical because here she is going to bat for British industry in apartheid South Africa. She marshaled all of the UK's resources to protect British investments in South Africa at a time where everybody else was pulling out. If that isn't massive government intervention in the market, I don't know what is. It's so incredibly hypocritical.
She was rabidly anti-communist, rabidly anti-socialist, except for socialism for the capitalists.
Well, that's exactly it. So anyway, this only really started to unravel in 1986 when the U.S. Congress finally passed the Comprehensive Anti-Apartheid Act. And I have to say that they did this by overriding Ronald Reagan's veto, her best buddy Ronald Reagan, who had vetoed the Anti-Apartheid Act, but basically Congress vetoed Reagan's opposition to this act. This happened on a day that South Africa viciously attacked and bombed Zimbabwe, Zambia, and Botswana. And there were Reagan and Thatcher saying, no, we can't have sanctions. We can't take any kind of action against South Africa. But that was kind of the beginning of the end of Thatcher's. U.S. Congress had passed that act and the United States had come on board with sanctions, then pretty much that was the beginning of the end of Thatcher's position. But she took one more whack at the ball. That was a year later when Brian Mulroney, who was part of that trio of conservative Western leaders, the one place where Mulroney distinguished himself from Reagan and Thatcher was at the Commonwealth. He did push for sanctions, and he and Margaret Thatcher went at each other like crazy over the whole sanctions issue, and she really locked horns with him over and over again in 87, but ended up losing that battle too. But all this to say, you know, South Africans, for the most part, are not mourning her passing. The exceptions are the vestiges of the apartheid regime, and I might point out Buthelezi, yes. who was a kind of very reactionary force in South Africa that helped to bolster apartheid, even though it was a Zulu nationalist movement, but very, very conservative. He came out yesterday mourning her passing. They were very good friends. She supported Buthelezi very much. Just absolutely vicious politics in those dying days of apartheid. I want to end on this point. I tried to find the author of this particular line. I can't. It's all over the place, but some brilliant person came up with it, and I just want to quote them: "The Iron Lady, may she rust in peace."
Oh,
and then somebody else added, "Just like British industry." Okay, we're going to go to our music, and we'll be back to say goodnight.